The risk of famine is growing every day. But what about the concern about a larger regional war? The White House said last night that it conducted airstrikes on militants in Iraq. Help us understand the bigger context here.
Well, the White House says three U.S. military personnel were wounded, one critically, in an attack by Kataib Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed group in Iraq. The U.S. responded with airstrikes. We're seeing these attacks from Iranian-backed groups that also back Hamas in the war against Israel. Houthi rebels in Yemen have been attacking commercial ships in the Red Sea, about a dozen or more in the past 2 months. The U.S. has responded by creating a naval coalition to protect commercial ships in the Red Sea. It's a wait-and-see attitude by the shipping companies. Some are going around Africa as a way to reach Europe. But again, this coalition of naval ships has just begun.
Right now, as we're talking about the possibility of a regional war, the fighting continues in Gaza. What do we know about any diplomatic efforts to try to stop it?
Well, Egypt has proposed a plan to bring an end to the war by installing a new governing body in Gaza to replace Hamas. Reuters news agency is reporting Hamas has rejected the deal. The Egyptian plan calls for the release of all hostages and the freeing of more imprisoned Palestinians, along with exchange of bodies of Israelis and Palestinians killed during the war. And now Qatar brokered the first ceasefire, as you might remember, with Hamas's political office in Doha. It's likely to be involved in any future deals, but we just don't know at this point.
NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
Democrats face an uphill battle in next year's elections to maintain their narrow majority in the U.S. Senate. The races test the polarization in red states and the extent to which the issue of abortion rights resonates with voters. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis has this preview.
In order to win re-election, Montana Democrat John Tester needs to defy recent history.
Montanans pride themselves in splitting tickets. But you have to give them a reason to do that.
Americans are finding fewer reasons to do just that. In the previous two presidential elections, just one state, Maine, split tickets electing a Democratic president and a Republican senator. Tester and Ohio Democrat Sherrod Brown are the two Democrats running in states where the Republican nominee, likely former President Trump, will likely win big again. If either senator loses, it could cost the Democratic majority. That's why Republican campaign operatives like Stephen Law, who runs the Senate Leadership Fund's Super PAC, are bullish about a takeover.
It will be hard for any of these senators in those states, these Democrats, to cobble together enough swing voters to put them over the top as long as we've got a credible candidate and we run an effective campaign.
Credible candidates and effective campaigns have eluded Senate Republicans in their quest for the majority in recent elections, costing the party seats they were favored to win in states like Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Georgia. And that's partly why Michigan Senator Gary Peters, who's running the Democrats' campaign operation, says his party has a shot to hold their majority.
Normally, the most extreme candidate gets out of a Republican primary. After the primary, they're also damaged in many ways, and their flaws are quite apparent to the voters. And when given that contrast, we win.
But there are few bright spots for Democrats. Joe Manchin's decision to retire means West Virginia is all but certain to flip to Republicans. Democrats could maintain control of their seven competitive seats and still lose control of a 50-50 Senate if President Biden loses. The vice president breaks the tie in a split Senate. Jessica Taylor, an election analyst with the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, put it this way.
Democrats have to pitch a perfect game. There is no room for error.
Meanwhile, Republicans are almost entirely on offense. Democrats will make runs at defeating incumbents like Ted Cruz in Texas and Rick Scott in Florida, but they are, for now, long-shot bids. That means Law, a close ally of Mitch McConnell, will be able to spend most of the Super PAC's projected $275 million war chest attacking Democrats rather than protecting Republicans.
With relatively little risk, it just means that the cycle is almost entirely upside.
The red state Democrats aren't without advantages. Tester and Brown are established, well-funded, and remain pretty popular back home. A recent Morning Consult poll had Tester with an eye-popping 61% approval rating. But being likable and getting reelected aren't the same thing, says Taylor.
Voters are no longer looking at a vote for Senate as a vote for the person. They're looking at it as a vote for who they want to control Congress.
Brown says his record as a progressive populist with his support for unions and worker rights still resonates in Ohio. He rejects the conventional wisdom that Democrats in states like his need to move to the middle to win.
Voters don't think in those terms. Pundits do, and maybe some reporters do, and maybe some of my colleagues do. But to me, it's whose side are you on?
With Biden's sagging popularity and a sour national mood on the economy, Democrats want to make the whose side are you on question central to all of their campaigns when it comes to abortion. Here's Tester again.
It shouldn't be the United States Senate telling a woman how to make their health care decisions. This is a little thing called freedom that Montanans value in a big, big way.
All of the Republicans running in the Ohio primary support a national abortion ban, which, if enacted, could supersede Ohio's recent referendum protecting abortion access.
Ohioans won't stand for, we voted for this, and these politicians that want to go off to Washington are going to repeal it.
Law concedes Republican candidates have to do better articulating their views on abortion or risk alienating swing voters.
They're going to have to spend campaign money to talk about it. They're going to have to deflect attacks and explain where they are.
Senate primary elections to determine those candidates begin in March. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
There's a traditional Christmas dish in Venezuela called hallacas, similar to tamales. Millions of Venezuelans who fled their country prepared this dish far from their homeland and relatives this year. KUER's Ciara Hewlett visited with one of those families in Utah.
Yesenia Castejon and her family have played this song every Christmas since they left Venezuela 6 years ago. It's about being away from family during the holiday. Yesenia's relatives are spread across the world, but they still make hallacas together over their phones.
We talk while doing it. Even from a distance, we see each other on the little screen, and like that, we feel a little closer.
17-year-old Valeria cuts vegetables for the filling and tells me that she doesn't know if she'll ever return to Venezuela. She says the future is very uncertain for migrants. Dad Anaximenes Chirinos says they left Venezuela because it's really unsafe and unstable.
You don't know if you should be more worried about common crime or be more afraid of law enforcement or of the state.
Cooking hallacas is reminding Yesenia of her mother back home.
I try to imitate my mom's hallaca, but it never turns out the same.
She mixes corn flour and water by hand to make the dough, or masa, then spreads it onto a banana leaf.
We spread the dough out nice and flat.
Then they add the filling on top before wrapping it up. Eight-year-old Leticia has cut heart shapes out of banana leaf scraps and wants them to go inside each hallaca.
Ay, qué bonita.
She says putting hearts on the hallacas is now a new tradition. Back in Venezuela, they would make 150 hallacas, but tonight they only made about 25. Yesenia says eating the hallaca transports her back to her homeland.
Definitivamente es eso. Volver transportarte a Venezuela es como.
For NPR News in South Jordan, Utah, I'm Ciara Hewlett.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this hour, the James Webb Space Telescope has revealed galaxies, stars, and black holes that formed in the early universe. 2023 was its first full year of science operations, and astronomers have much to ponder after the year's discoveries. That story in about 15 minutes here on WPR.
As the cold of winter approaches, warm yourself with beautiful music, friendly conversation, and stories that sparkle like falling snow. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. This holiday season, we're here to keep you informed and entertained, whether you're at home, at work, or on the go. Find our complete schedule of programs at WPR.org/holidays, and thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Residential Moving, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. More information, including move estimates, at ReynoldsTransfer.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to keeping local resources local by encouraging families to begin tax-advantaged giving, strengthening nonprofits, and improving lives. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
Temperatures will fall today to the upper 30s to mid 40s by this afternoon. Light rain in northern Wisconsin, but conditions should clear up throughout the day. Tomorrow we'll see a chance of flurries, otherwise partly to mostly sunny for the day. Highs will be again in the mid 30s to low 40s with light winds. On Thursday, mostly dry with highs in the mid 30s to low 40s, and we'll continue to see light winds.
Comes from this station and from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at publicwelfare.org. From Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure the future of Africa's wildlife and wildlands. Learn more at awf.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Asma Khalid. The Academy Award-winning director Steve McQueen has a new film out in theaters this week called Occupied City. It's a four-hour meditative documentary that provides two simultaneous portraits of Amsterdam. One, a journey through modern routine life, recent years of pandemic and protest. The other, a record of atrocities during the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands in the early 1940s.
In May 1940, Amsterdam was taken over by the Germans. Immediately, they set the clock forward. So it was the same time in Amsterdam as in Berlin. The weather report disappeared from the newspapers. It was now a military secret. All streetlights were turned off. Dutch organizations were Nazified or forbidden. Soon, the Nazis started to ban Jews from parks, pools, shops, cafes, and schools, from all public life. Music by Jewish composers could no longer be played. In 1941, they started rounding people up. In 1942, the deportations began.
Earlier, I sat down with McQueen and his wife, the historian Bianca Stichter. She wrote Atlas of an Occupied City, the book that inspired this documentary. But Stichter says there are some key differences between the book and the film.
The film is more of a free wandering through the city, and the book is more practically set up like a guidebook.
The documentary is over 4 hours long, a runtime that McQueen adamantly defends.
This couldn't be an hour and a half film. It needed that contemplation, needed that meditation to sort of get into the psyche of the cinema experience, and that time was very important for us.
So this is a film that shows contemporary scenes of Amsterdam. There's not archival footage. It's narrated by a younger woman. Was there a purpose behind that choice? And help us understand what you were trying to convey.
I think it was a voice of not that time. It was a voice of now. There was optimism in the person's voice, even though there was a dispassionate sort of description of what was going on. And that was because I didn't want to manipulate the audience. It was about the audience sort of bringing the information, receiving the information for the first time. So it was about that moment where it was not about her being sort of dictating a history lesson. It was about her telling you what was happening.
You shot part of the film during the COVID pandemic, and there is this juxtaposition at moments during the film where we see lockdowns in Amsterdam while listening to the narrator describe how Nazis used curfews to punish Jews during World War II. What were you trying to tell us with that juxtaposition?
It's about what happened here. This is the meditation of what happened here in Amsterdam during the Nazi occupation. These things happened, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're living now, and we're living with the evidence and the proof of what happened.
You hear these horrific bits of information about what happened, and you see these contemporary scenes of life going on. There is this powerful disconnect with the information that I'm hearing from the narrator and the images that I'm seeing.
People have died and fought and died for freedom, and the freedom for people to do what they want. And these so-called horrible things happen, yes, but it was to do with war. And in war, horrible things happen. But now, you know, there's peace in Europe for now. Well, some parts of Europe, there's peace. You know, it would have been a different world had the Nazis had won the war, the Second World War.
The film in that way is very open, and the texts you hear are very factual. So we are not telling you what to think. You can try to make a connection between what you hear about the past and what you see now, or not. That is open to each individual viewer.
You live in Amsterdam now. Do you feel that the city, that the citizens of Amsterdam have a sense of this past that you are conveying here in the film?
Some do and some don't. I mean, just like slavery in America, some people have an understanding of it, some people don't. I mean, it's like anything, you know, some people do, some people don't. I mean, last time myself and Bianca were in Washington, we stumbled across there was no marking then. There was where Solomon Northup's slave pen was, and where his hotel where he was kidnapped in Washington. So, yeah, these things are there, and, you know, they're there. It's like, again, as I said before, when I came to Amsterdam, in the real way, I felt I was living with ghosts. So what Occupy City is about is illuminating that past. When you go to the movies, people try to connect. They try to connect the dots, try to make sense of things. But what your lessons learned from this situation is nothing makes sense, because how can you even fathom or sort of get to an understanding of how, for example, you know, during this war, 6 million people, Jewish people and Roma and gay people died. Try and make sense of that.
This kind of pondering is what the movie makes you do. How do you connect the past and the present? Can you make sense out of it? Or do you have to conclude that a lot of times you cannot make sense of it? When you hear all these stories, at a certain moment you realize, hey, these people from the past that we only see, if we see them in pictures, it's in black and white and very grainy and looks very old, not our concern. And here you realize, but those people are us. They also lived in a world full of color and emotions, and this movie is also a mirror in that sense.
Do you want viewers to take a message away from the film?
The message is that the Nazis didn't win, and there's this new generation of Jewish people who are thriving and living in Amsterdam. That's what the end of the movie is, obviously.
It's not a movie that spells it out in every minute. We give you the facts, and then it's also up to you to make up your own mind. Mm-hmm. It's not a film wagging a finger at you. It's a film that I hope will make you think for yourself.
Exactly. It's not a history lesson. You know, there's tons of books that you can have and that people know about. But again, if it's about a certain meditation, a journey, if you will. And it's one of those situations where the responsibility is on you as a viewer, as a different way of looking at a narrative. It has to be, because otherwise you're just doing the same thing all over again.
That was director Steve McQueen, along with his wife, the writer and historian Bianca Stiekscher. The film, Occupied City, is out in theaters this week. This is NPR News.
The new movie, All of Us Strangers, is a love story between two men that feels slightly unreal, like a fairy tale. But writer-director Andrew Haig also wanted to ground his film in some kind of reality.
All of our decisions sort of came around, like, what does it feel like to be alone? And then what does it feel like to be intimate again with someone? What does it feel like to connect?
I'm Ari Shapiro. More on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. It's just before 8:30. National news from NPR and state news from WPR is on the way. One of the oldest University of Wisconsin training programs is continuing in River Falls. More in the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The U.S. military has carried out airstrikes in Iraq. The White House says President Biden ordered the strikes against an Iranian-backed militia group. NPR's Giles Snyder reports three U.S. service members were injured in a drone attack in northern Iraq.
The White House says President Biden ordered the retaliatory strikes after he was briefed on the drone attack while spending Christmas at the presidential retreat at Camp David. The Pentagon says the strikes destroyed multiple facilities used by a group called Kataeb Hezbollah and that a number of militants were likely killed. Kataeb Hezbollah had claimed responsibility for the drone attack on a base in Erbil used by U.S. forces. Officials say three U.S. service members were injured, one of them critically. Iranian-backed militants have carried out dozens of attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Severe weather is sweeping across parts of the nation's midsection. The National Weather Service says a major winter storm is hitting the northern central plains. Forecasters have posted blizzard warnings from Colorado to South Dakota. Up to a half inch of ice is expected in some areas. Stocks on Wall Street are trading higher at this hour. The Dow is up 10 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Hope Kerwin. One of the oldest University of Wisconsin training programs has relaunched this year in River Falls. Corrine Hess reports the Farm and Industry Short Course teaches farmers everything from accounting to giving a cow an IV.
Tyler Coles has wanted to be a dairy farmer since high school, but he put his hopes on hold to join the military and then work other jobs. Coles thought it was too late and too expensive to pursue his dream. Then he learned about the 16-week farm and industry short course at UW River Falls.
For me, I'm older. I have two children. And I'm making a career change, you know, something that was short, 16 weeks, really, you know, played a huge benefit for myself and my family.
The course has been held for more than 130 years at UW-Madison. Declining enrollment moved the program to River Falls this year. A push from state dairy farmers and legislators made sure it didn't shut down. Students earn 8 college credits that can later be applied to 2 or 4 year degrees. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A pedestrian in Madison was seriously hurt after being hit by a vehicle Monday night. WKOW-TV reports Madison police and the city's fire department were called to West Badger Road just before 9 o'clock last night. A police spokesperson said the pedestrian was taken to the hospital with serious injuries. He said the vehicle involved in the crash stayed on scene and is cooperating with the investigation. Warm weather over the last few days set new records in some areas of the state. In western Wisconsin, yesterday had the warmest low temperatures on record for communities like Genoa and Sparta. There were also record high temperatures in Alma and Friendship over the weekend, reaching the low 50s. The previous records were set in 1936 and 1940. In Milwaukee, temperatures over the weekend tied records for the warmest lows. The previous records were set in 1941 and 1877. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Milwaukee is on track for the warmest December on record, while Madison could reach the second warmest. Temperatures falling to the upper 30s to mid 40s by the afternoon today. Light rain in northern Wisconsin this morning, but conditions should continue to clear up throughout the day. Tomorrow, chances of flurries, otherwise partly to mostly sunny for the day. Highs will be in the mid 30s to low 40s with light winds. On Thursday, mostly dry, and we'll continue to see partly cloudy skies and light winds.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from American Jewish World Service, supporting human rights advocates worldwide in the fight for democracy, equity, and justice for all people. Learn more at ajws.org. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Leila Fadel. President Biden has been trying to get more money for Ukraine from Congress, but Republicans in Congress say they first want to see big changes in policies at the southern U.S. border. Biden says he's willing to compromise, but big changes could alienate Latino voters ahead of the 2024 election. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has this story.
When he was running for president in 2020, then-candidate Joe Biden said immigration was a top priority.
I'll be president of the United States, not vice president of the United States. And the fact is, I've made it very clear. Within 100 days, I'm going to send to the United States Congress a pathway to citizenship for over 11 million undocumented people.
And in his first days in office, he got to work, rolling back some of the hardline policies of former President Donald Trump. But his plans for legislation quickly stalled. And 3 years later, there's still no path to citizenship. And instead, Biden is looking at more restrictions. Democratic Latino leaders are worried.
We are urging the Biden administration to say no.
That's Nanette Barragan, chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus.
We are saying that we're going to put basically an end to asylum. We cannot allow that to happen.
Andrea Flores is a former Biden official at the National Security Council. She's disappointed at what she sees as a drastic shift in what Biden appears to be willing to accept.
I never thought that President Biden would oversee the end to the promise of immigration reform in the Democratic Party.
Flores now works with the immigration advocacy group Forward.us. She warns there could be a political price for the shift.
Well, he's not moving to the center. He's moving to a set of policies that, once again, are just, they are so extreme, and then now they're being sold to the public as though they're not.
The White House says they're in touch with Democratic leaders about their concerns. But they're also facing pressure from other Democrats to do something about the record number of migrants arriving at the border. Last week, the Arizona governor, Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, sent National Guard troops to the border to help. The surge is straining resources in cities as far away as Chicago and New York, where Democratic Mayor Eric Adams is pressing Biden to do more.
And that coalition is getting louder, more organized, and they clearly in saying the same things, that this is a national problem that should not fall on the backs of local cities.
Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly backs the push for stronger border measures. He says communities are running out of resources to help migrants find safe places to sleep.
And that means they'll be released in the streets. And if you think this crisis is bad today, if that starts to happen, this is going to be much worse.
According to a new poll by the Democratic strategy group Blueprint, a majority of Americans support stronger action on the border. Evan Roth Smith, the head pollster of the group, says the findings point to a potential winning strategy for Biden.
And to some extent, every politician has to test at times their most loyal voters in order to try and win over the swing voters who determine close elections.
He says Biden needs to thread the needle of doing right by the voters who are his base, while also appealing to independent voters who are up for grabs in critical states.
I would much rather Joe Biden win the election in the fall with a handful of compromises behind him and lose the election to Donald Trump, who is going to be on the other side of just about every issue that anyone in the Democratic base cares about.
And he says Joe Biden would not be the first president to compromise on a sensitive issue to improve his election odds. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
It was 2 years ago on Christmas Day when NASA launched the James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful space telescope ever. This huge telescope had to unfold itself out in space, and all of its instruments had to be calibrated and tested, a process that took months. That means this year, 2023, was its first full calendar year of actually doing science. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce asked astronomers what they learned.
At the start of the year, astronomers were kind of tired. They'd just been through the first exciting months of getting data from this telescope. Jacob Bean is with the University of Chicago. He says that period was like the beginning of a marathon.
And so, like, you take off, right? And the surge, and everyone's going, right? And you're following the crowd. And then after a while, you realize, like, hey, we got to run 26 miles. And for Genevieve Stee, it's like, this thing's going to last for 20 years. So, like, you try to settle into a sustainable pace.
Even though the initial frenzy has slowed down, he says the telescope keeps delivering big time. Take his area of astronomy. He studies planets that go around distant stars.
Each data set for each planet that we look at is more insightful than almost every other observation we ever did before.
He says what's clear now is that gas giant planets, even if they're about the same size, can have quite different atmospheres. Nature seems to have different recipes for making them.
The diversity of these objects is the surprising thing.
He says there was one kind of bummer this year when the telescope looked at a star called TRAPPIST-1. It's orbited by 7 rocky planets. Astronomers thought this was the system where this telescope had the best chance of spotting a planet capable of supporting life.
It's the best one that we know of, and really the only one where we're going to be able to do this.
But observations of the 2 innermost planets show that they seem to be bare rocks with no atmospheres. The gases might have gotten blown off by the star. That's because the star is more active than our own. It randomly erupts, sending out flares. Bean says that means its other planets may also be barren. Plus, all that star activity makes it hard to study them. Still, there were plenty of other wins. Garth Illingworth is with the University of California, Santa Cruz. He says when this telescope first switched on, it detected light from unexpectedly bright galaxies in the early universe. Over the last year, scientists have been able to learn more about them.
We're finding that a lot of these galaxies have a significant contribution from black holes, from the light from black holes. And so that's part of the reason why they appear so bright.
The James Webb Space Telescope even found the most distant confirmed black hole ever. Priya Natarajan is at Yale University. She says this black hole is 10 times more massive than the one at the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And this behemoth existed when the universe was only about 500 million years old.
In the infant universe, literally, you have this huge black hole and its host galaxy in place. And that's super exciting.
She says it shows how black holes can form in multiple ways, as it seems to have formed from a huge cloud of collapsing gas rather than from a dying star. Meanwhile, the organization that manages the telescope has gathered proposals for where in the sky to point it during the next round of observations, which start in the summer. Nearly 2,000 proposals came in. That's a record for any space telescope. There's so many proposals, the vast majority won't make the cut. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 now. Coming up on Morning Edition, Canada has found itself in an uneasy confrontations with both China and India this year, forcing it to face up to a new geopolitical reality. We'll hear more on that story still to come here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's more than a century of information, connection, and inspiration for the people of Wisconsin. When you give, you ensure that WPR's bright future includes plenty of in-depth news, world-class music, and thought-provoking discussions and entertainment. Thank you for supporting the important role of WPR in your community with your year-end gift right now at wpr.org/donate.
Support for WPR comes from the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Dedicated to protecting the state's lands, waters, and wildlife, and connecting all people with nature in Wisconsin. More is at wisconservation.org.
Support comes from UW Parkside's Adventures in Lifelong Learning, offering a group called Great Decisions. This group is part of America's largest discussion program on world affairs. For more information, visit uwp.edu/ALL.
Wisconsin Public Radio, here's some of what's happening in the news. Minimum wage workers in 22 states are going to see more money in their paychecks in the new year. The list includes Minnesota and Illinois. 20 states will maintain the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, including Wisconsin. Holiday travel was relatively smooth for millions of people traveling this weekend. Less than 200 flights had been canceled and around 2,100 flights were delayed as of yesterday afternoon.
Delays and cancellations marred holiday travel last year, including the Southwest Airlines debacle that stranded more than 2 million people last year. You can find more news anytime on our website or start your day with WPR's daily news podcast, Wisconsin Today.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing how people and communities can come together in polarizing times on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Therapy and healing can come from creating art. And that's what one group of intertribal women found as they worked through generational trauma that Native Americans experience. Cassidy Arena of member station Nebraska Public Media takes us to a special event.
Please make sure that your phones are either on silent or off for the duration of the fashion show.
The lights dim in the packed auditorium in downtown Omaha on December 3rd. The fashion show is about to begin. Backstage, the models are giddy with excitement. Kimberly Bedford is with her 4-year-old granddaughter, Odyssey. They are both Santee Sioux and are wearing traditional Native tea dresses. Bedford thought of her son, Odyssey's father, while she sewed them. He died in a car accident last year.
When I got involved with sewing, you know, it took my mind off things. You know, I mean, it didn't make that situation go away, but it helped, you know. Like, I'm glad I can do this with her, because I know he would be glad.
This fashion event showcasing Native American beadwork, ribbon skirts, and jingle dresses was organized by a local group called Healing Ribbons. It's an intergenerational, intertribal group of women from Nebraska and Iowa who all come together to sew. Healing Ribbons co-founder Tammy Buffalohead McGill started the program in memory of her sister, who froze to death 5 years ago.
Well, I discovered when I was at the sewing classes, I felt that. I felt for the first time that a boulder had been lifted off my shoulders.
The women in this group are on their healing journey from centuries of historic trauma, and more recent ones, too. Native American communities suffered a disproportionate loss of life due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Buffalohead McGill alone lost 8 close family members, and she says many of the Native lives lost to the virus were culture bearers for the community.
So all of a sudden, not only we lost people that we loved, but then we lost people that were the ones that taught us and instructed us and helped us learn who we are and give us that sense of identity and connection.
And there's another cause of pain. In 2021, recovered records indicated nearly 100 children at a government-run indigenous boarding school in the central region of the state had died there. The school closed in 1934. A series of digs have taken place on the former school's 640-acre grounds to find the children suspected to be buried there. Digs will continue this spring.
That re-traumatized a lot of people, but it also started a dialogue.
Historical traumas are seen as a soul wound for many Native American communities, according to Dr. Natalie Avalos, an assistant ethnic studies professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, who is of Mexican indigenous descent.
Things like trauma are actually hereditary. They can change your DNA, and that we can pass them on generationally.
And Avalos says a potent way to heal from that trauma caused by generations of violence and marginalization is through participating in culturally relevant practices, like hosting a fashion show.
Doing these things together, it rehumanizes because it enables people to see the beauty of their own culture. It's a way of really taking back your power.
Kimberly Bedford hopes this show will teach her granddaughter to feel empowered by her culture.
I just want her to be proud of who she is. You know, when she says she's Indian or Native American, you know, that she knows a little bit about her history.
Although the women in the fashion show agree it didn't make their traumas disappear, it helped to know they weren't alone, allowing for a new way to feel proud of their identity. for NPR News, I'm Cassidy Arena, Nebraska.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll get the latest Wisconsin news coming up just after 9 o'clock. A group of filmmakers from the Ho-Chunk Nation have received an Emmy Award for a documentary on the life of artist and tribal member Truman Lowe. WPR's Jenny Peek has more on that story in the newscast. Then Peter Bryant will bring you Morning Classics.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire. Convenient scheduling and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.
NPR.org.
It's 8:50 on this Tuesday morning. In sports, the Milwaukee Bucks lost to the New York Knicks yesterday. They next face the Brooklyn Nets tomorrow night at 6:30. In the weather forecast, temperatures falling to the upper 30s and mid-40s by the afternoon today. Light rain in northern Wisconsin this morning, but conditions should continue to clear up throughout the day. Tomorrow, chances for flurries, otherwise partly to mostly sunny for the day. Highs in the mid-30s to low 40s with light winds. On Thursday, mostly dry with highs again in the mid-30s to low 40s. We'll continue to see light winds on Thursday with partly cloudy skies. On Friday, nice weather is expected with dry conditions and plenty of sunshine. Highs reaching the upper 30s to low 40s for the day.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Asma Khalid. Canada enjoys a reputation of being a friendly country, but over the past year, it has found itself in spats with some powerful nations, China and India among them. Ottawa accuses both of meddling in everything from politics to domestic security, which is forcing Canada to re-examine its policies and its identity. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
Ice skaters bundled up against the cold zip around an outdoor rink in front of Ottawa City Hall. Trees around the rink sparkle with Christmas lights. Their bright colors bounce off snow, covering the lawn and sidewalks. It is a quintessential Canadian scene, one that for years shaped how many Canadians saw their place in the world.
I think about when I was a kid and where we, you know, we had a rosy view of our international role, and nobody was out there to harm Canadians, and Canadians could be all friends to all people on all issues.
Jonathan Berkshire Miller is a foreign affairs specialist with the Macdonald Laurier Institute, a think tank in Ottawa. He says that benign view of Canada has been sorely shaken recently.
And we're starting to wake up to some of these very hard realities that many states around the world have interests adversarial to Canada.
That became apparent in September when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau stood before Parliament and accused the Indian government of taking part in the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar, a Sikh activist in British Columbia.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty.
The news of an extrajudicial killing stunned many Canadians. The Sikh community was not as surprised. At the Gurdwara Sahib, a Sikh temple on the outskirts of Ottawa, a religious leader wearing a dark turban reads from a holy book. A collection of swords is on display on the dais. Canada has a sizable Sikh community, and New Delhi claims many are extremists trying to carve a homeland, Khalistan, on Indian soil. Balpreet Singh is legal counsel and spokesperson for the World Sikh Organization of Canada.
The history of India's targeting of Sikhs in Canada, it's something that Sikhs have lived with for many, many years, and people in the mainstream are finally aware that India is engaging in very nefarious activities targeting Sikhs.
But foreign interference in Canada goes beyond India. In 2010, the head of Canada's intelligence service, the CSIS, warned about China meddling in Canadian affairs. There are large ethnic Chinese communities in Toronto and on the West Coast.
The threat of foreign interference is so nuanced that it's easy to look at it and say, what's the big deal?
Dan Stanton is a former senior intelligence officer with the CSIS and ran its China program for a time.
Incrementally, you see a very comprehensive approach towards a country like Canada. Like, they're hitting all the sectors, media, political, government, and diaspora communities to facilitate the promotion of their policies.
China is also focusing on universities and think tanks. Colin Robertson is a former diplomat and fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, a think tank in Ottawa. He says for years, Canada was complacent about the threats facing it because of its geographic position.
There was some sense that we were simply sleeping through this because we've got the protection of the American security umbrella and we've got three oceans and we don't really have to worry about this kind of thing.
This is a view echoed by Senator Peter Beam, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee.
The large power wants to make an example of a middle power. We are almost a sitting duck as the 11th or 12th largest economy in the world. And we would also be seen as a bit of a surrogate for the U.S. if a country wants to send a message to the U.S., blame Canada. But I think that was on South Park at one point, too.
There have been a number of other incidents that have shaken Canada from a security stupor. In 2018, China arrested two Canadian citizens. It was broadly seen as retaliation for Canada detaining a senior executive of the Chinese telecommunications company Huawei at the behest of the Trump administration. The relationship soured further after leaked intelligence reports showed China was trying to pressure members of parliament and skew political campaigns.
When I went door knocking, people opening the door and they heard my name and they just basically shut in my face, just within a very short 22 months period.
Kenny Chu was elected to parliament in 2019 and was widely expected to be re-elected in 2021. But he started calling for a registry for foreign agents as a way to curb outside interference. Speaking from his home near Richmond, B.C., he says he criticized a Chinese crackdown in Hong Kong. Shortly after, his political fortunes changed.
And just recently, in October, Canadian Security Intelligence Services had a debriefing, finally, with me, confirming with me that I was under the disinformation campaign attack during last election.
The Canadian government is now taking action.
Silence, please, for prayer!
Canada's parliament has launched an inquiry into foreign interference in national elections in 2019 and 2021.
Now please announce the speaker.
Stephanie Carvin, a former CSIS intelligence officer now at Carleton University, says Canada has underfunded its national security. She says it's hoped the inquiry will lead to more robust, enforceable national security policies.
The fact is that our laws are very much out of date. The national security tends to be neglected by politicians who would rather provide things like dental plans, like daycare.
But Jonathan Berkshire Miller with the Macdonald Laurier Institute says there's only so much Canada can do compared to, say, the U.S.
The United States still has that heft where it can push back on certain issues. I think increasingly Canada is seen as a very, very soft and easy target, even though we have strong affiliations and alliances with the United States.
And that could be tested more in the future as economic and geopolitical power shifts more towards countries like India and China. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Ottawa.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Hope Kerwin. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR for you every hour. And there's always more news at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9 o'clock now.
Support for WPR comes from UW Health and the Mount Horeb Area Arts Association. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Offsite, providing co-managed and fully managed IT solutions to help their clients navigate the complexity of running operations across multiple data centers, cloud platforms, and software applications. Visit off-site.com/radio. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.